This is Pacifica's Peace Watch for Friday, September 19th, 2003. I'm Verna Avery Brown. Former UN Chief Weapons Inspector Hans Blix attacked the spin and hype behind U.S. and British allegations of banned Iraqi weapons used to justify war against Saddam Hussein. Blix, who said this week he believed Iraq had destroyed its weapons of mass destruction 10 years ago, told BBC Radio that the U.S. and Britain overinterpreted intelligence about Baghdad's weapons programs. In response, the British government said it stood by the case it made to the public for going to war. The call to help create peace in the world is a calling a young teacher in the Washington, D.C. area has been answering for quite some time. 24-year-old Rajiv Kasat, high school teacher, poet, and spiritualist, has traveled around the world and into the inner sanctuary of his own consciousness to study and manufacture the building blocks for a peaceful world. Rajiv says no matter where one travels, they always remain in the same place unless they are willing to change. His thoughts are expressed in his book titled Trails, and his emotions are portrayed through his poetic works, some of which he shared during his visit to our Peace Watch studios.
There is no greater sickness in the world today than the lack of love. Mother Teresa. For a moment, I couldn't even think of a reason not to walk. War is the enemy, a mutual enemy shared by ex-war heroes and draft dodgers. The state of our world has us in constant mobilization. There is no halt to the peace movement. There are no culminating activities and special events we must prepare for. The peace movement must happen every second of every day. It begins in the movements of your lips as they form the words that will be sent to another human being. The peace movement is never ending. In every movement, we must be peace. Of course, I had no reason not to care. I don't believe bombs, tanks, or fighter jets solve problems. This is a democracy, and yes, contrary to public opinion, it is patriotic to express your beliefs. In fact, it would be unpatriotic not to express your feelings of concern and doubt in what could become a third world war. The voice rang loud and apparently angry. But I continued walking as if I should let a little anger stop me. It drove me. But when I took a few moments to breathe deeply, I realized a clear contradiction. I was engulfed by my own self-hatred. I was using the instruments of my oppressors. And in the process, I became exactly that which I hated. Hate. Yes, I walked and I tried to ask other people who were chanting, "Bush, you're a whore. We don't want your oil war. Why are you demonizing the individual? Why are you assassinating his character? Why is it that we get pulled down to their level and in the process become exactly that which we claim opposition? Why do we still not hear Booker T. Washington? Don't ever let them pull you down so low as to hate them. Our peace movement, not yet recalling the full teachings of our prophets, has forgotten that we must love our enemies. So many of my fellow human beings are placing all the blame on Bush, pointing fingers as if he is the cause for all this mayhem, as if he is the only one responsible for the desire of oil. And I thought to myself, if I really care, I'd stop driving my car. So I stopped my verbal abuse and I encouraged those around me who were projecting their hatred to do so as well. I thought perhaps we should all walk in silence. At least that is, until our broken leg is healed. A broken leg, and where is the cast? If the leg is broken, which apparently it is, shouldn't we not walk on it? Well, the therapy? Are you going to listen to someone who calls you a whore? I know I'm going to put up a wall and not want to hear what comes next out of their mouth. So for every person who understands that peace requires effective and sincere communication, and that without the dialogue we are left stranded in the middle of a battlefield with landmines and insinuations, I ask you again, Don't you want him to listen? Don't you want him to hear what you are saying? Because either way, no matter what happens, Bush will be in office for 2 more years, and with that knowledge, wouldn't it be more effective to speak to him as a human being? You see, some may hate him, but the hate that we have for Bush is the same hate he uses to order missiles that will result in the deaths of more human beings. And that hate that we wield for Saddam Hussein is his excuse for continuing to kill his own people. And in the end, we are all beings who are uniquely human. And whether you agree or disagree, mustn't we find it in our hearts to love unconditionally? Even those who may at the moment be contributing more to the violence than alleviating it. No one should be allowed to kill anyone, and I'm not excusing anyone's actions, but in the beginning, we were all one day a baby coming out of our mommy's womb, and in the end, even after being behind bars and isolated from ever being able to hurt other people, we must continue living and be shown the light and the error of our ways. Love is the only force that can do this, for no one is past redemption. Yes, be angry. I'm angry. But let's find a way to channel our anger creatively and lovingly. Let's understand that anger does not allow an individual to think clearly and act effectively. Let's grow together in our movements and embrace some basic principles. If we desire to live with peace on the earth, then we must have compassion for all life. And that does not exclude George Bush or Osama bin Laden. If we desire to bring an end to war, then the only solution is love. And so I submit to you my most heartfelt proposal. Bombs don't solve problems, and really our enemies are but misunderstood friends. We are together in this war, in this celebration, in this amalgamation of reality, placing our egos to the side and living briefly with our hearts open to the dream. Imagine. Not everyone will feel as you feel, but even if we disagree, we still have to live together. That is the reality. So let me say finally, with courage and belief, that I love my parents. No, really, I love you, Mom and Dad. And well, I love my friends also. Just as I love my teacher and that bully on the playground who she saved me from. Yes, could you believe it? I love George W. Bush and I love Osama bin Laden. Both equally, without distinction or reservation. I'll even go as far to say that I love Saddam Hussein, and I love Dick Cheney, Ariel Sharon, and Yasser Arafat. And yes, of course, I love you, each and every one of you. Because really, people are one and the same, and I understand that we have all heard at one time or another. Yes, I love the winter as much as I love the spring, and I have resolved to love the people that are most hated. And no, there will be no riots. No, we will not damage property, because with our heightened consciousness, we will realize our connection to each other. And no matter what type of violence we're using, the only person that we can destroy is ourselves. By throwing a rock through a window here in Washington, D.C., you are as responsible as any Israeli soldier standing at some checkpoint with a rifle aimed at some child's head, or a suicide bomber taking out 3 people in a van. By not being nonviolent in our approach, we contradict everything that we claim to support. No, there will be no peace in the world as long as police beat protesters with clubs, and protesters call police pigs. But let me return to the beginning. I'm walking in forgiveness. There is a way out of the cycle of violence. There are no enemies. There is, however, a force that paralyzes our evolution: hatred. And a force that guarantees our existence: love.
Rajiv Arakasit, described as born financially privileged, mentally curious, emotionally sensitive, and attitudinally stubborn. That's a powerful piece, Rajiv. Welcome to Peace Watch.
Thank you for having me.
There's so much that we can talk about, so much that your piece leaves us with. I want to focus on the challenge, however, that you put to the listeners. The challenge to speak to Bush, President Bush, as a human being, to get him to hear you. Explain to us how going inside of oneself and being in a space of love and being able to speak to Bush as a human being and from a place of love will actually have an impact on the forces that are in play in this country and the world today.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think the most important thing for us to do is to recognize that inside Bush are parts of ourselves, and inside parts of ourselves are parts of George Bush. Just like anybody who we pass on the street will share traits and characteristics of Saddam Hussein or Osama bin Laden, there's this idea of separation that really pervades the mentality, I think, of our consciousness right now. And I think the fact that we even could think that we are separate from these human beings who really are the same people in essence as we are is the illusion which keeps us at war. The challenge that I think I've placed on myself before anything is to love myself, because the hatred I have for other people is an inability for myself to love the parts of me that I want to deny.
One of the things I like about your piece is that you say we can't place all the blame on President Bush. And you say, if I really cared, I'd stop driving my car. Yeah. So when you point fingers, how does it go? You point your finger and four of them are pointing back at you. And so I think that's a part of this puzzle that many of us have not identified and care to respond to the challenge to the individual. Mm-hmm. You teach high school students in the nation's capital at Woodrow Wilson Senior High alternatives to violence.
Well, and this is part of where the piece even was given birth, is my work at the high school. The fact that I teach nonviolence and I teach peace in schools requires me to love every student that walks through that door unconditionally.
Tall order.
Tall order.
Mm-hmm. Looking through your syllabus for your class, I see where you break violence down into three categories: physical, psychological, and structural. And I think we're all pretty much familiar with physical violence and probably psychological too, but give us an example of what you mean by psychological and structural violence.
Well, structural violence is basically when you have medicine sitting in warehouses and pharmaceutical companies. You have tons of medicine that could be being used at this moment to provide children with cures for malaria, or let's say medicines that will prolong people's lives who are living with AIDS. And these medicines are sitting in warehouses and they're not being used. And what's going to happen is they're going to spoil after a number of years. And because people don't have the money to buy the medicine is not going to be used. It stays in the warehouses. People die while they could be receiving the medicine. The medicine goes bad.
Mm-hmm. Would sanctions against Iraq qualify as structural violence in your opinion?
Yes. In my opinion, it would. In my humble opinion. But the challenge really that we were faced with at the rally was finding a way to approach this situation with love, mm-hmm. you know, and to realize that loving our enemies is the hardest thing to do. And it really begins with loving ourselves. And so you're asking me about the classes and the peace education classes. The hardest thing I found, I mean, I work with some of the youth here in the inner city of D.C. that are very... they've been going through a lot at home. You know, mm-hmm. they have not had the easiest childhoods. And to recognize that everybody is a child and everybody at some point has had experiences that have made them, you know, become who they are.
And you're teaching them to love their enemy.
Well, yeah.
And that includes the guy over there in the classroom that's likely to try to steal your tennis shoes or wants to pick a fight with you at the locker.
Yeah, we read Martin Luther King. We read everything from Tolstoy to Gandhi to Dorothy Day. Like I was saying, King wrote this amazing essay that was really partly the inspiration to the poem that was just played. Mm-hmm. It's called Loving Your Enemies. Mm-hmm. And that essay, we read that essay and we really spend a lot of time just working on it.
Mm-hmm. What is it about that essay that that really inspired you?
Forgiveness. You know, in practicing forgiveness, the hardest thing to do is to forgive someone, you know. And so in terms of the cycle of violence, there's a cycle, you know, that we're stuck in right now. And the only way out of the cycle, to the best of my knowledge, is forgiveness.
I see here on your syllabus where you speak to the children and you to the students and you engage them in things like role playing and simulative cooperative games. What would be an example of that? Does someone get to be Saddam Hussein, for example, or someone get to play George Bush?
We haven't done that quite yet, although that's a good idea. That's a real good idea. No, but we'll go through some role plays occasionally. We'll bring like Oreos into class and we'll have
cookies,
mm-hmm. like Oreo cookies mm-hmm. in the class, and divide the class into countries, like five students in each country, and each country will have their own demographical breakdown of wealth and population, and they'll get a certain amount of cookies per population for the country they're in, and they'll mm-hmm. get to see how many cookies each person in Afghanistan has to share. So they might have half a cookie for 18 million people, and then you'll see how many cookies somebody in France has mm-hmm. for this many people, and then they'll kind of have to divide the cookies up amongst themselves, and they'll have to come together as a whole class and see really just the disparities in wealth, which is another example of structural violence. I mean, violence exists and is caused when there are huge, huge disparities in power. And when there's huge disparities in power, you're going to have one class of people who we call the oppressed that are going to do whatever they can do to, you know what I mean, try mm-hmm. to no longer be servants.
Mm-hmm.
And this is
achieve part of the wealth.
Right.
How do you deal with the oil well situation and the wealth, the natural wealth of some of these countries that is not necessarily being distributed throughout the people?
Well, everything to me at this point, I mean, I'm still very much learning, but everything to me comes down to a consciousness and an attitude. I think we set off on the wrong foot when we believed in Darwin's evolutionary biology perspective of survival of the fittest. I believe that really as a species, we are going to have a much greater chance of survival if we cooperate with each other. A lot of this battle on natural resources is a battle out of fear, a fear of not realizing that there is an abundance. Mother Earth has enough resources on this planet. We have enough sunlight coming from the sun to provide everybody on the planet with food, to provide everybody on the planet with their own solar-powered running vehicle and car and house and home and water. I mean, it's all here. It's not like there's a lack of resources. But the thing is, there's so much fear within people that there isn't enough for everybody to share that we begin to adopt this mentality of, well, I need to grab as much as I can for myself. Mm-hmm. Because if I don't get it for myself, then, you know, I'm not going to get any, which isn't true, which is an illusion, which is part of our even believing in Darwin's whole competition, you know, and comes back down to the system again. When you have a system that awards people that can stab somebody else in the back and do better for themselves, mm-hmm. you know, that kind of system is exactly what we even see in the schools right now with grades and with putting children in boxes and making them numbers and percentages instead of recognizing mm-hmm. that each kid, each child is a person, you know.
If you were in a Baptist church right now, somebody would be saying, "Preach, brother, preach." You're 24 years old.
Right.
How'd you get so smart? I think probably your travels had mm-hmm. a little bit to do with that.
It's the world perspective, I think, was brought through the travels. I just recently came back from a long trip to Africa. I was traveling alone through West Africa, sleeping on people's floors, whom I met that very same day in a village somewhere on a bush taxi. They would invite me back to their homes. I had nowhere to go. I had no itinerary. You know, I was just kind of just moving by the spirit.
Mm-hmm.
And I would say yes, I'd go back. I'd end up eating dinner with their families, you know, meeting his or her wives and children. And it was those kind of experiences that have really opened me up, I think. I wouldn't consider myself smart by any means, though. You know what I mean? I would just consider myself someone who cares deeply about what's happening and cares deeply about what we can do as a people. Because I don't believe in separation. Again, I feel that we're afraid to recognize how similar we are. Mm-hmm. And it's the fact that we want to separate ourselves so far from Saddam Hussein, or we want to separate ourselves so far from George Bush, that we don't want to see how we really are very similar, you know. And it's that kind of, and that's why we'll go and say that we hate these people and not want to, you can't change somebody by hating them. You know, even if we killed Saddam Hussein, he's going to come back with a different name and a different body and a different person. You know, you got to transform the people. And transformation only happens through love, which is the part in the poem.
Mm-hmm. You were born in Princeton, New Jersey, but you grew up in India. How much did that experience shape you into the young man who you are today, who's determined to teach peace to high school students and to organize and educate through the arts?
Right, right. Well, I wouldn't say I grew up my whole childhood in India. I would say it was more of a back and forth kind of experience. Mm-hmm. I would spend 2 or 3 years in New Jersey, and then I would travel to India for 3 or 4 months.
Mm, okay.
And I would go back to Jersey, and then back to India, back to New Jersey, back to India.
And is that where you noticed the similarities, the sameness?
It was a stretch, though, because, I mean, I was living in poverty when I went to India. You know, we would share these rooms, literally 8-foot by 8-foot rooms, 2 rooms for 12 people. You know, we would all sleep on the floors, and there was not enough food for everyone to share. I mean, the last thing you would ever do is throw some food out. You know, you clean your plate every time. Mm-hmm. And then going from that to New Jersey.
What was your lifestyle like there?
Where we had suburban town, you know, a house, a home with 4 or 5 bedrooms in it. You know, my own bed, my own refrigerator that I could open and grab a glass of milk at will, you know, and just to be going back and forth. But at the same time, I was young at this point, so I would play with children. I would play with kids my own age in India. I would come back and I would play with kids my own age in New Jersey. And it was the same experience to me. Kids are kids. Mm-hmm. No matter where you go, they're playing hide and seek or they're playing tag. You know what I mean? So it's really, in essence, I mean, yeah, there's these things that disguise the situation, but and what I found a lot was just the amount of love that I found in India, the amount of love that I found in Africa was just so much more vibrant, was so much more encompassing than what I've found here in the United States. And I think, unfortunately, all this wealth and materialism, the materialism really is killing our spirits and our souls. And it's that the whole book is I'm trying to get away from this materialism that really has almost like taken a hold of me arbitrarily. I didn't want it to happen, but you can't help it but happen while you're here living in America, to be wasteful, you know, because we are wasteful people. And there's no denying that.
The name of your book is Trails. In your book, you quote Mahatma Gandhi, "An eye for an eye leaves the whole world blind." Was Gandhi a guiding force in your spiritual development?
Yeah, you know what? The experience that really made me feel connected to Gandhi, when I was in South Africa for the World Conference Against Racism, I traveled out to the outskirts of Durban, and I went to Gandhi's home. Mm. And I spent a day out at his home. And that experience really made me, I burnt some sage. I sat and just meditated the whole day. At where he spent close to 23, 27 years of his life.
Mm-hmm.
And I've done a lot of extensive reading on Gandhian philosophy and just his life and his experiments with truth.
What came to you during that meditation?
Let's just say my body was shivering a little bit. You know, I really don't know what thoughts necessarily came to me other than that we're all very responsible for where we are in the world today. And I realize that through the fortunes that I've been blessed with, the fact that I've been to college, and the fact that my brothers and sisters in India have always wanted to come to America and have the opportunities that I have, that I'm very responsible to help open doors for these people that need access to simple things, you know, that they don't have. And that's what really came to me, is that I'm here, you know, with a purpose, just like all of us are, you know, but I just recognized and decided to act on the purpose and the reason I'm here.
Is that what prompted you to hitchhike across America and on to Western Africa, or was that during that?
Well, that was all part of my own experiment, my experiment with people and how people would react to me. as I said earlier, there's so much fear in this country. We live in literally a police state. People lock their doors. You know, 30, 40 years ago, it wasn't nearly as bad as it is now, but people won't leave their keys in their cars or won't leave their doors unlocked, and there's so much fear. And so I was in California, and I was thinking to myself, well, people really don't hitchhike nowadays because of all this fear. I'm not going to play into it. I'm not going to let them brainwash me. I'm going to hitchhike. And so I got on the highway, had my friend drop me off on the highway, put my thumb up in the air, and I started hitchhiking. And I spent a month hitchhiking from California to New Jersey, just to see if I could do it, just to see if it's really true, like, should I really be afraid? And I think one of the reasons that I did survive and make it the whole way through hitchhiking cross country through America or traveling alone through Africa was the fact that I don't have fear in my heart in that way. You know, mm-hmm. I don't fear people. I talk to strangers.
And so that was not your experience because you did not draw that to
exactly.
you.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
You also quote an ancient proverb, you must listen to be heard. Is this something that came to you in your travels on your way to Western Africa, perhaps?
That came to me through, I think, the work in the school with the students. Mm-hmm. I can't tell you how much I've been learning through being in this environment with, I mean, I don't consider myself a teacher.
Well, you know, say in your syllabus, the teacher is the student and the student is the teacher.
Exactly. And that's the kind of pedagogy I'm bringing into the classroom. It's not hierarchical. It's not like a dictatorship. And when you look at traditional classrooms, they're dictatorships. It's a teacher indoctrinating you with information. And this is no. The information exists within your minds. And I'm just here to facilitate that information coming out of you. So I had to really just, like, a lot of what people need is to be listened to. Mm-hmm. And heard. And my travels through Africa just confirmed all of that with just how friendly people are and how welcoming people are. You know, it's unbelievable how you can go to an African village and you don't need police to maintain order. You can have a village of 5,000 people in Africa, villages that I've stayed in, you know, where there's no police, there's no locks, there's no alarm clocks even. People don't, you know, people tell time by the sun and people, mm-hmm. people move at their own pace, and there's so much freedom in that. You know, we think we're so free here in the United States, and sometimes we forget how chained we are to this lifestyle of materialism and this lifestyle of, well, if I'm not wearing this kind of t-shirt or if I don't have this kind of hat on, then I'm not going to be accepted. You know what I mean? And it's that kind of, it's that kind of fear that inhibits our freedom here, which I didn't find there in Africa, which is why I know I have to go back, you know, because that's somewhere I felt very, very open to spirit and just to people being so loving. Mm-hmm. It was tremendous to me, just the experience out there. I encourage everyone to please get out of the country and see life elsewhere.
Rajiv Kasat's book Trails was awarded the National Certificate of Merit Writer's Digest Self-Published Book Award in 2001. He is currently preparing to leave for India and expects his new book, Evolutionary, to be published in the next few weeks. You're listening to Pacifica's Peace Watch. I'm Verna Avery Brown. We'll be back in a moment.